Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it.
Well, there's nothing like catching a timely interview, with last Monday having been President's Day. We're going to speak now with an author, a writer for all reasons, Tom Fitzgerald, based in Rhode Island. Good morning, Tom. How are you today?
Well, it's good afternoon here, so good morning to you and good afternoon to us.
Exactly. You got it. Well, Tom, let me give a brief introduction. He led a Huckleberry Finn childhood on the St. Lawrence River before undertaking formal studies in physics, mathematics, law, industrial management, and English. Tom has served as a door-to-door salesman of home study courses, a vocational counselor for adult and children with developmental disabilities, a stockbroker, the assistant to the president of a large healthcare corporation, a lobbyist, a technical writer, and a corporate manager. Tom also served as a Navy SEAL during the Vietnam era. He's run the Boston Marathon three times, swam several long distances, including the eastern end of Lake Ontario, which is a distance greater than the English Channel. And Tom and his wife of 45 years, who is a marriage and family therapist, have three grown sons and three grandsons, so they live in New England. Now, Tom's tagline, A Writer for All Reasons, and his new book, Poor Richard's Lament, invites us to really take a look at today's America through the lens of the past, in particular through the eyes of Benjamin Franklin. In this, what was said, the painstakingly researched and really terrifically imaginative book that was 9 years in the making, Tom brings Benjamin Franklin back to America 225 years after his death, which was in 1790, and he is now standing trial at the Celestial Court. He's granted the opportunity to witness what has happened to his beloved country and to find redemption of his own personal shortcomings. Tom, tell me, was Benjamin Franklin a longtime historic figure in your life?
Well, I guess he was, but I didn't realize the extent that he was.
Mm-hmm.
I think just about every American is fascinated with this man because he's so multifaceted. He's a true genius, but at the same time, he's approachable. We don't tend to put him up on a pedestal the way we do with George Washington and some of the other founding fathers. We could actually, I think, a lot of us picture ourselves in a pub somewhere.
That's right.
Having a beer with him, you know. Mm-hmm, he's that kind of character. But I read his autobiography originally in college, and then in 1993 I reread it, and as I was rereading it, the muse whispered in my ear, what if Ben Franklin came back?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and it just seemed like he would, if you're going to pick a character to do this with, he was the one.
He was the one. So
yeah.
you just said you reread it in college, and then you read it again in 1990, you said.
So 1993. Yeah.
1993. So yes. Again, that's a number of years ago that now you just here recently completed a nine-year trek to write this book.
Yeah.
So you've had the voices of Ben Franklin and the other characters you bring forward in this wonderful book in your head for quite some time.
Yeah, they live here.
They live here, yeah.
Moved in.
Moved in. And
yeah.
And so why and how was it you started if you had been traveling with them so long like you had been?
Yeah, well, it was in 1993 I got that idea, that concept, but I didn't do anything with it until after about another 10 years. And my original concept was something light and fluffy, picturing Ben Franklin having a real romp in modern-day America.
Mm-hmm.
He would just be enthralled with all our gadgets and technologies because he was an inventor.
Sure.
And an improver. So it just seemed like just the natural character to put in that venue. Like so many of these adventures, it got away from me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once I put him in, started putting him in written form, of course, he took over.
You know, that's really right. It's really true. I think I have interviewed many writers, several of fiction, that say, well, I have no idea how the story was going to end. They were just kind of guiding my pen, you know, or guiding my keyboard.
And I think you're exactly right. That's exactly what you want to happen. So you become sort of the midwife of the whole thing, and facilitating it, but not trying to control it overly much. So that's what happened.
That's right. Well, give a sense to our listeners the structure then of Poor Richard's Lament. And, of course, that's a play on Poor Richard's Almanac, which, of course, he did 25-plus editions of.
Yes. The novel is divided roughly into two parts. In the first part, as you mentioned, Ben Franklin has been confined to a private apartment in purgatory for the last 225 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he's supposed to have been contemplating his mistakes, which there were many. You don't get them in the history books, but I got them in my research.
Mm-hmm.
So all these, he's confronted. He's taken to the celestial court because he hasn't done the job. He added 12 more volumes to his autobiography instead of doing his work.
Right.
So he gets hauled up in front of the celestial court, and he's examined by three old arch enemies, including John Adams.
Right.
So there's a lot of repartee here that replicates the rocky relationship between those two men back when they were both alive on Earth, particularly on Adams' side. He was really insanely jealous of Franklin.
What I would also could insert, by the way, for our listeners, is that these sections of the book are written in the language of the day as well. So, Tom, your versatility, your tagline, a writer for all reasons, I would add, and seasons in the mix. So your versatility as a writer, it takes you back to the sentence structure, the vernacular of a different day.
Yes, and that's a whole story unto itself, but maybe we can get back to that.
Yes.
So anyway, Ben is examined by these three old arch enemies, and the reader learns about all the negative things that Ben Franklin had done, including his participation in the commerce and convenience of slavery, his treatment of his family, mm-hmm. which was often cruel, and several other things. So at the end of this examination, Ben actually feels that he's going to be pushed into the fiery pit, and that'll be it. Instead, he's invited to come back to bear witness to what's become of his what he would call his dear country in the 225 years of his absence. And the second part of the novel is his Odyssey of Witness, which begins in Boston, where he was born. He goes through New York City. He gives a homily, a talk on leadership in the Waldorf Astoria, mm-hmm. the Grand Ballroom there. He ends up in Philadelphia. He rides a Segway that's loaned to him around through the campus of University of Pennsylvania, which he founded, and he ends up at his gravesite at Christ Church Burying Ground in Philadelphia. So that's the structure. The first part is necessary to set up the second part.
And the other part, of course, is you've interwoven a modern-day tale of what's going on in a relatively seedy way outside of Washington, D.C.,
Yeah, so he gets a peek at what really has become of his country and how that contrasts with what his expectations had been. It also allows me to make contrasts as I go through between there. One of the main characters in the story within the story is a Franklin-like figure who has become the chief advisor to the president, and he has no scruples whatsoever. He's just clever and imaginative, and he figures out a way to make sure that to ensure the president's reelection. And so Ben is getting glimpses of this, but also for the reader, you're getting a buildup of contrast between the ideal that Ben Franklin represents himself, but also anticipated, and what has actually going on in our country. And leadership is a big part of this novel. Just as I mentioned, Ben gives a homily on leadership at the Waldorf Astoria. But throughout the novel, you get these contrasts between what I call a real, authentic leader is and what we've ended up with.
Yes, and I think that from that regard, while your book is going to be called historical fiction, it might also, though, be contemporary leadership. And pulling across multiple places. I have to believe this is one of those books that were it to be in a conventional bookstore, it'd have to be placed at four or five different sections of the bookstore or the same way online because, well, is it historical fiction? Is it this? And in fact, I love the fact your subtitle, Poor Richard's Lament, by the way, we're speaking with Tom Fitzgerald in Rhode Island, that the subtitle is A Most Timely Tale. Of course, a tremendous play on words, timely from the standpoint of Ben Franklin coming back after 225 years of being in purgatory, but also timely from the current day back. So you're dealing in multiple clocks, timelines. In fact, you even start the book out with this nice timeline of explaining to the reader, for those who may not know, of the notoriety of Ben Franklin, to follow those significant things throughout his life that really at the day and time as a founding father was heavily part of the evolution of the United States.
Yes, it was. I mean, all those founding fathers had enormous influence because there were so few of them, mm-hmm. and the context was so much less complicated and noisy compared to what it is today. It's one of those times in history you just can't imagine that it ever happened, that these people all came together at the time that they did and did what they did. And a lot of them, like Ben Franklin, they also had flaws. I mean, John Adams had, if you watch the HBO series mm-hmm. on John Adams, you saw all his flaws. I mean, all these individuals had flaws. And to me, that helps us become endeared to them because it makes them more human and approachable.
Sure, and it actually brings history really to a more authentic place in real life. You know, Tom, the fact that this was a 9-year journey, just the writing, let alone carrying the voices in your head, like you said, for so many other years. How did you possibly go about doing the type of real research that would give you the authentic data you've now portrayed in this book? What were your sources?
Boy, if I had known ahead of time how much of that was going to be involved, I would have never entered into this enterprise.
Which is good, which we hear from a lot of people. It's a good thing I didn't know that before I started.
Yes, oh boy. I mean, it became clear I had to really get to know this man, and you can't get to know a person from one biography. You know, a lot of them are hagiographies. They're in love with their subject, and they paint them in the best light, and a lot of that goes on, so you have to be wary of that, but you also have to tap multiple sources so you get different slants, different windows into the same spirit and soul. So I had a lot of that to do, just a lot of reading. And then there's the background reading for the Times.
Sure, exactly.
Oh, John Adams as well as Ben Franklin, because he plays a big role also. And then there was language. You mentioned the language.
Yes,
now we can get back to that. I discovered early on that the diction, the 18th century diction, is very different from modern times. It's much more complex, ornate, subtle. And just a lot of things that our language is not today.
And what if
and
I might offer? Yeah, you had to learn it, not just
to
read
it. Learning a foreign language, and that took I can't tell you how much work that took when I actually tried to put it on paper. It just I use the analogy of a wooden bell versus a crystal bell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every time I'd go over it, and it'd sound like a wooden bell, and I'd go back over it, and it'd sound like a wooden bell, and finally it would. It would sound like a crystal bell, so then I would go on to the next this paragraph of speech and do the same thing with that. And so I'd say probably of the 9 years, at least half of it was taken up just getting the language right.
Language, fabulous. We're speaking, by the way, with Tom Fitzgerald. His book is Poor Richard's Lament, A Most Timely Tale. In fact, you can learn more about it by going to poorrichardslament.com. So, Tom, the idea of learning a foreign language. The other piece of it, that what's so endearing for the reader, and I found myself going through this as I really had to slow myself down during that period at Celestial Court, for a variety of reasons, just the deliciousness of this different language that you were teaching me through, but also the terminology and the antics and the theatrics. You know, in particular, the series, because, of course, he's famous for his 13 virtues that are portrayed in his autobiography from a masculine standpoint. But you bring in 13 young girls that don't have faces. So the metaphors that you were poking at us when you read this book are really profound.
Yes, and this occurs early on in the second half of the novel. When Ben Franklin's brought into the Celestial Court, he's reminded of his 13 virtues, mm-hmm. and then he's asked. He's famous for two of them: industry and frugality. These are the mercantile, or what I call the masculine virtues, and he was touting them because any young man back in his time had to embrace these virtues in order to be successful in any regard materially. And it was a matter of life and death, not so much the way it is today, but back then it was. So these virtues were very important to get across. But what it did, it created, in my mind, it created a lack of balance.
Yep.
He's touting the material virtues, but then there's by implication, there's the immaterial, or the, what I call the spiritual or feminine virtues, compassion, empathy, generosity, forbearance, and 13 of those. And it's so what I wanted to show the reader at the very beginning was this imbalance between the masculine and the feminine virtues, and what effect, and then ask the question, what effect might that imbalance have over 225 years?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're witnessing today the fruits of that lack of balance. So he's taken the task for it, for that lack of balance, or at least it's pointed out to him to own or not. But it's a way for me to establish the overall thesis of the novel is that whenever you have I use the analogy of a washing machine that has all the wet towels on one side.
Oh yeah.
If somebody says, well, what's wrong? It's out of balance. Things have to be in balance. Nature needs to be in balance. And when things aren't out of balance, you there's hell to pay. I mean, that's why we have thunderstorms, because there's an imbalance in electrical charge between two things. So this was essential, and the girls, when they represent the 13 feminine virtues, and they have no faces because they have no voice.
No voice, exactly. Yeah. So that,
and they haven't had for 225 years. So we've had the masculine voice; it was necessary, but so is the other half.
Yeah, to come back in balance. Well, of course, your analogy too of comment about thunderstorms. Of course, many people from your childhood, we know the pictures of Ben Franklin with the string, the kite, and the key, and his uncovering of electricity. Most people don't know, though, the other elements of his inventiveness. Perhaps you could touch on a few of his other inventions, and also the fact that he never patented them. What's with that?
This is a wonderful thing about Ben Franklin, and an example that I wish was more conspicuous today.
Mm-hmm.
He invented so many things. I mean, it's just the bifocal lens, the Franklin stove, the lightning rod. I mean, the lightning rod alone. I mean, back then, every lightning strike ended in a fire. Philadelphia burned down 100 times. London burned down. You know, everything burned down because everything was wooden, and they had no protection from lightning. And this is one of the reasons why he refused to patent any of these inventions. He never made a dime out of any one of those things that he invented. And he gave them to the public domain because he knew that he could do an awful lot of good if he did that. If he monopolized, then he could charge exorbitant prices for all these things and maximize his revenue. But he didn't want that. He wanted the opposite. He wanted as many as people as possible to take advantage of these inventions. And he people don't realize this, but you know, fire just almost disappeared as a threat.
That's
because
right.
of the lightning rod alone. Then there's a Franklin stove. You know, the alternative back then was pretty much the fireplace. And it's very inefficient. You put a log in the fireplace, and 90% of the heat goes up in the chimney. But he invented the stove that just revolutionized that whole area, and everybody could almost everybody could benefit from it because he didn't patent it.
Right, in the same way, of course, him being a publisher and a printer and involved in the founder of the post office system, tying it back to the ability to read, the capability of bifocal lenses.
Yes, you could. All those things are of a mix. I mean, if Ben Franklin were with us today, he would have 100 websites going because he just believed in the dissemination of knowledge. He felt that was the way to any kind of government succeeding is that it would have that in place.
Yeah, well put. Tom, your book came out in 2012. Of course, you're not the only individual that's written a book on Ben Franklin. What kind of connections have you gotten from other writers, autobiographers, biographers, historians so far with your book, Poor Richard's Lament?
It's been very positive. One person in particular, Michael Zuckerman, who's a professor of history at University of Pennsylvania, which is the school that Ben founded.
Founded, yes.
I found him in one of the documentaries about Ben Franklin. I really liked him. And so I made contact at through the University of Pennsylvania and arranged to meet him and gave him my whole concept. He just right from the beginning, he just loved it and encouraged me, and he was very supportive. And when I was getting toward the end of the drafting of the novel, I was really flagging in spirit because I started to approach agents and publishers.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
Couldn't get anybody to be manifest any interest at all. So I got so full of despair that I was ready to give up the project. And I had sent him, I didn't ask his permission, but I sent him the manuscript and didn't hear from him for 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got in the letter, in the mail one day, I got a 5-page letter from him, just extolling the virtues of this novel in his eyes. And he sort of rescued the project.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because I was getting good feedback from family, but you want feedback from outside your family, and especially someone in his position where he was a Franklin scholar of great repute. And to get that kind of validation from him was just unbelievable. It just I can't say enough how valuable it is for people. He sort of manifested the generosity of Ben Franklin.
Right, exactly. That's
the kind of thing that Ben Franklin would do, and he did. He answered everybody that wrote him. He answered back, and now they've collected all those writings in 38 volumes at Yale University. I mean, he couldn't resist responding to people who wanted to talk about things that he thought were important.
Well, and you know, it also goes to show you, Tom, that the journey of any writer is not one that is done singularly, that your profession, like any other, benefits from having a support group or team around you. Sometimes, like you said, it's not the people that are closest to us, but those that we reach out and they fuel it. The reaction you've gotten so far from the general public, other than Zara Larsson here on Circles of Change, who thinks this is a fabulous book. I've already got 5 copies coming from Tom, incidentally, because I have many people that I know, interesting, that have followed Ben Franklin, that they, like you, were affected greatly by him when they were in their formative years. But any comments you've gotten back from the general public yet?
Oh, yes. The reviews have been just wonderful. All the reviews on Amazon.com have all been 5-star. Other reviews, but we've had the same difficulty I had in trying to get attention from. It's so hard these days to get anybody's attention. Everybody is
We're so busy because of 100 websites out there by Ben Franklin wannabes, right?
So I would send out review copies. The publisher would send out review copies. But we've had a tough time, other than on Amazon.com, we've had a tough time getting reviews, you know, and usually like Kirkus Review and some of these other long-established places just wouldn't read the book.
Well, I mean, you know what, it's going to just take some time and take some of the right triggers from who knows how. That's the mystery of it all. Tom, so tell me, this is a 9-year journey. How do you think you've changed in the process of that journey and traveling with Ben Franklin and transmitting this story to words? What about you personally? How have you changed?
It told me that my entire life up to the point when I started this project was preparation for the project.
Yeah.
Everything that I had ever done, everything that I thought was meaningless, everything I thought was a failure, wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
It all came to bear in some form in this project, and I was so glad that I had, like going through SEAL training.
Mm-hmm.
If I hadn't gone through SEAL training, I don't think I could have ever endured the 9 years that I spent on this project, because it was so arduous at times. And I wouldn't, I prepared for SEAL training by doing long distance swims across Lake Ontario. It's just like you said, everything was a build up to this project, and I had to take advantage.
We go back to the fact, in your introduction there, I mentioned that you'd been a door-to-door salesman at some point in time, so there's a little bit of that now calling upon, tickling your fancy of get your sneakers on, get moving, the technical writer side, and also the corporate manager side, right? I mean, your ability to speak authentically through the characters you've portrayed in this book, you know, some of them probably were that guy you hated working for at one time that you now call something different in your book.
Exactly right. That's point I was trying to make. You did it much better.
Well, maybe in a different voice. Well, Tom Fitzgerald, our heartiest congratulations. The book, again, for our listeners is Poor Richard's Lament, A Most Timely Tale. You can go to that website, poorrichardslament.com, as well as amazon.com. And Tom, as I mentioned, we're going to look forward to attracting you, hopefully, to come to Tucson for the Festival of Books in 2014, because by then I'm sure it's going to have a bunch of gold stickers on it for various awards and commendations. So all the best of you. Thanks a lot for contributing to our show today. And salute Ben Franklin in his role in President's Day and then some.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.